the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, this week, Barron's Magazine had a feature article about financial abuse, or what we refer to as elder abuse, with the aging, especially with those that develop problems like Alzheimer's or dementia. Joining me on the program is Carolyn Rosenblatt. She's an elder law attorney. Carolyn, it was amazing. This article in Barron started out with a family, I guess quite wealthy, somewhere in the neighborhood of $4 or $5 million. Seven children, two of the daughters had been divorced, and they were given power of attorney to take care of mom and dad. Well, mom and dad eventually developed dementia. In over a couple years, these two daughters took $700,000 out of the estate. The only way the other siblings found out was there was a $100,000 tax bill due on capital gains. But you deal with this all the time. Is this becoming more common? At least in my practice, I'm seeing more of it.
Yes, Jim, it is more common. Part of the reason for that is that people are living longer. And as they live longer, there is a steadily increasing risk of diminished capacity because of things like Alzheimer's disease and other problems. So we're all seeing more of it. And you know, the most recent study that I've seen, which was pretty comprehensive, puts the annual amount stolen from elders every year at $34
billion. $34 billion?
That's right. Over $34 billion, in fact. It's frightening. And that means stealing from every way there is. From predators on the internet to people who sell somebody a magazine subscription and then the elder doesn't want it and they don't know how to stop it, to errors in bills, to outright theft by adult children or other relatives who have access to the elder's account.
We hear about a lot of tax schemes, and the Barron's article talked about, for example, an elder couple contacted by the IRS saying they owe back taxes, wire transfer the money, or debit cards. And you and I know that's not the way the IRS does things. They usually send you a letter, and if you're going to settle, you're going to write a check to the IRS, not wire transfer to some bank account. In most of this elder abuse, the $34 billion that you talk about, is this mainly somebody defrauding elderly couples with false investment schemes or like this IRS scheme? Or is it children that are basically taking money from their parents' estate?
Unfortunately, the majority of financial elder abuse is by family members. Then behind them are friends, people they trust. And there's this problem we call undue influence, which is that the predator uses their relationship of trust with the elder to take advantage of them and harm the elder in the process. The next category in order of numbers would be caregivers. And again, for obvious reasons, the elder is dependent, the caregiver is providing essential services to them, and the caregiver knows how vulnerable the elder is. So sometimes they are persuaded or even coerced into giving that caregiver access to their funds. And behind that, unfortunately, are professionals, and that includes financial advisors, accountants, lawyers, clergy people, others who are in a position of trust whom the elder is victimized by because they see the opportunity and they seize it, all to the detriment of the elder.
So when you see this with children, and this I see a very common thing I see in my practice, where let's say husband and wife name their children as successor trustees or give them the power of attorney. As you pointed out, a lot of this abuse comes from the children, but does it come in the way of you have a situation that there could be a check and a balance? Let's say in this case that the Barron's article talked about there were seven children. Two of these children were the caretakers. What are the checks or the balances that could be put in place so that you know what the person that has been given the power of attorney out of the children, what they're doing, so you're kept up to date, or there's some kind of check and balance?
Right, there needs to be. And a lot of people don't think about that because they think they're never going to get dementia. So let's say the matriarch and the patriarch appoint Sonny Boy, their oldest child, to be the power of attorney, and maybe the successor trustee on the family trust where all the money is. And Sonny Boy's got a drug problem, or he likes to gamble, or he wants this child to start a business, as was in the Barron's article, or some other thing that involves taking a chunk of the elder's money away and doesn't tell anybody else. And the elder has not foreseen that that's going to happen. So they've not built anything into the power of attorney or the estate documents, like the trust or will, to account for that possibility. What the adult children can do, Jim, is as soon as it becomes clear that the elder is no longer able to manage, they're forgetting to pay bills, or they've had a diagnosis, or they had a stroke, there's a problem, and everybody knows about it, and the appointed person or persons takes over the reins and begins to deal with the money. The other siblings or family members need to hold that person accountable. There's no rule or law or court appearance required for someone who's the agent on anybody else's power of attorney. That's unfortunate, because in the wrong hands, it's a license to steal. In the right hands, it's the best way to protect an elder without having to go to court and get a guardianship. Or in California, we call it a conservatorship. But I think the very best thing other family members can do, whether they get along with the appointed person or not, is to insist on a monthly accounting of the elder's fund or online access. Everybody can have online access to see where the account information is and what's happening to it, so that everybody knows. And how do you set this up if the elder didn't? You have a family meeting. That can be by phone, or ideally it's in person. And at this time of year, when families tend to get together, that's a really good time for folks to be talking about what they're going to do in the event that the matriarch or the patriarch loses their ability to manage independently, and how they're going to make sure that everyone has transparency about their financial information.
Carolyn, what about, for example, setting up some kind of issue with like a financial advisor? Because certainly the financial advisor who may be handling the account sees, you know, the regular distributions. One of the things that we've seen or become alert to is when we set up a distribution rate for a client drawing down, all of a sudden we see erratic activity. Either one, I had a situation where the husband developed dementia and all of a sudden he was doing things that didn't make sense. Or you see somebody like a child that has a power of attorney all of a sudden start making extra withdrawals. What about alerting your advisor in giving that advisor the ability to contact other family members as a check?
We consider that absolutely critical here at AgingParents.com and AgingInvestor.com. Part of our business, and I am a registered nurse and an attorney, and my partner is a geriatric psychologist. We provide consulting information to financial advisors, too, because we think you all are in a unique position to protect your clients. And maybe you've got kind of an automatic thing going on where the drawdown is a certain amount, but you're also in a unique position to spot irregularities, as you just described. We have a book called Succeed with Senior Clients, A Financial Advisor's Guide to Best Practices, and that walks you through the warning signs of financial abuse, one of which is a radical change or any really significant change in the pattern of withdrawals from the client's account. We also have a course for all of you financial people out there, whether you're a CPA, advisor, wealth manager, and it's what you can do about the crime of the century, which is financial elder abuse. And that's available for credit as well for continuing education. But what it all gets down to is that every advisor needs to at least have a checklist of the warning signs of financial abuse, what to look for, and a very important corollary to that is you need permission from your client to contact an identified other person whom they trust, and we recommend having at least two of those other people, again for checks and balances, so that when you see something fishy going on, you have someone to call to try to stop the problem or at least look into why it's going on.
Carolyn, is there a special form? You have things like powers of attorney. You have co-trustees. What about the idea of a co-trustee? Let's say that a parent only has one child, so they name that one child and give them the power or make them a trustee. What about having an independent co-trustee or a check on that? Because a lot of times, you know, you may have children, even though one child has been given the authority to act on behalf of the parents, but you may have other children that just aren't financially sharp enough to pick up that things are going on.
That's right. And a lot of times siblings don't get along. They're named as co-trustees because the client's trying to be fair, and it's a terrible idea, because one of them can veto doing anything that is safe and best for the elder. So an independent person is a good idea if the family members who are potential appointees don't get along, or if one of them's kind of got a screw loose. There's always some black sheep, you know, in the family. So you don't want to put that person on any legal documents. But if the elder has made that mistake and, you know, they're still competent enough to change their documents, it's a good time to ask an aging parent to do that. We recommend that people consider the use of, in California, we have licensed fiduciaries, professional people who are appointed sometimes as conservators or other roles that they play in helping people who are not competent to manage their money. So involving a licensed professional fiduciary can be a good way to enable the safety of the elder when there is question about family members. And the options exist within nonprofit organizations. There are people who act independently as licensed professional fiduciaries. They are not all created equal. You do have to do a lot of vetting, but I've had some pretty good luck with nonprofit organizations where licensed fiduciaries work, and they serve the needs of impaired people, disabled people, incompetent people to serve as the one whom everybody has to run things by. And that can be a very good way to keep the person financially safe.
So what do we do if we could run down some of the obvious red flags that should alert our listeners if they have a parent out there that either has a caretaker taking care of their parent, has one of the children as, let's say, a power of attorney, or even a friend, because I've seen actually, especially in a lot of the senior centers, sometimes they will name a friend that is close by or lives in the same center because they know me, and they give them that power of trust. What are some of the red flags that you should warn our listeners for? I mean, one of the things we see is an increase of unusual activity, either in distributions, lump sum distributions, or even erratic investment activity.
Right. There are some classic warning signs. We have them posted on both of our websites at agingparents.com and aginginvestor.com. They're also in our books, but I'll just give you a few of them. Isolation of the elder is a classic. And that means that someone who's been caretaker or has control or influence over the elder gradually or suddenly stops allowing other people to contact that person. They might even move them out of their home. They call it granny napping, where you steal grandma and take her to someplace else where nobody can find out what's happened to her. But isolation by refusing to allow phone calls, email, visits with some excuse after another, that's one really big red flag. If you, the advisor, are trying to reach your client and there keeps being no answer to the phone, you send an email or letter and there's no answer to that, it's time to alert someone, even the local police department, to do a welfare check to find out if the elder is still there. And the police department will go out to do a welfare check, at least in our state, to find out if the elder's okay. You can at least get some information that way. There are many other warning signs, but I think the unusual withdrawals is a big one. That's a classic, and I dearly wish that more financial professionals paid attention to that because you're in a unique position to see it right away. There are other things, which would be the presence of a friend, a so-called friend, who suddenly appears in the elder's life but has never been there before, and they seem to have an inordinate interest in the elder's money, asking a lot of questions, being on the phone or in the background when you're talking to them. And that person seems to have suspicious motives, particularly if they don't have any income, if they have a criminal record, or they like to go to Las Vegas and gamble, or whatever. So that's another big red flag. The other one that's a classic is the romantic interest. This is particularly sort of dangerous when you have a recently widowed person who's very lonely, they're grieving, they're vulnerable, and someone sidles up to them and starts showing tremendous interest in a romantic relationship with them. This is someone with ulterior motives. And yes, of course, there are new relationships that happen and people do fall in love after they've lost a spouse. But, you know, depending on where it is, I mean, we had a case here where there was the woman at the dry cleaners and she knew that this gentleman's wife had died after several years of having cancer. He was very lonely. And, you know, 2 weeks after she died, this woman had moved into his house and borrowed hundreds of thousands of dollars. So that would be a classic predatory actor here. So those are some of the big ones that I think everybody needs to be aware of. There are others. If a person has previously been abused by anybody financially, that's a red flag telling you that they may be subject to that again.
And what about some of the scams? A lot of times, maybe the couple doesn't realize they're just not as sharp as they used to be. One of my favorites, that you've seen this on the news recently, is the IRS scam. You know, everybody's sort of afraid of the IRS, and you get this call, hey, we're the IRS, you owe us money, and they direct a bank account or a debit card.
Sure, that's a classic, and it's very intimidating, especially for people who maybe weren't born in this country or they have limited skill in dealing with money. They get terrified by these calls, and that's the purpose. I personally have gotten one of these calls. It was a message from a man with a sort of authoritative voice telling me that we owed the IRS money and that I needed to call back immediately. And I thought, oh my gosh, this scam knows no limits. But they're messing with the wrong person when they're messing with me. But that's not the way it is for most folks. You know, most people don't know that the IRS will never call you on the phone and demand money, and that they are required to communicate in writing for everything they do. So that's one. There are scams all over the place, Jim. Another famous one that's had press for years, which I've written about in my blogs, is the grandma scam. And this is where they call the elder at home. They maybe know a little bit about the elder, or maybe they're just dialing for dollars. One scammer said it took 50 calls to get one taker, but it's easier than robbing a bank, and they almost always are successful in getting someone to wire money. But the scam works like this. The elder is just waking up early in the morning or late at night, and they get a phone call, and it says, Grandma, and the grandparent says, Billy, is that you? And now the scammer knows the name. Yes, it's me, Grandma. Gee, you sound different. Well, I've got a cold. Actually, I'm in Mexico, and I'm in jail. Don't tell my parents. I've had some trouble. I got in a car accident. I really need some money to get out of jail. And then the elder, of course, you know, hears, I love you, Grandma. I know you're the only one who can help me. And they fall for it. They'll wire money, and then they wake up in the morning and go, wait a second. Then they call the grandson, who's, you know, just finished his classes at school, and says, what's up, Grandma? So it's an unfortunate, very successful scam that has been used against hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of elders, and they're still getting away with it. That's just two, okay? The IRS one and the grandma scam are just two. There are dozens of these.
And the other thing, too, is especially in this low interest rate environment that we see right now, where you're not getting much on things like treasury bills or CDs, somebody calling with a too-good-to-be-true, safe investment. And I'm always amazed at the trust that some people will have giving a complete stranger on the phone, that they win their trust because they know how to sell them, they know how to talk to them, and as seniors will write these checks. And sometimes when they find out it's a scam, here's the sad part, Carolyn, they're afraid to talk to anybody about it or notify the authorities because they're embarrassed.
That's right. And they say that out of every 44 cases of financial abuse like that, a very small percentage, something like 9 or 10%, are ever reported. And it is because of shame and embarrassment, because when they realize they've been duped, they feel so stupid. It's been horrible. I mean, suicides have even occurred over this. There is a huge emotional impact to financial abuse, and we all pay the price. But I think families really need to be aware of the risks, and there are plenty of things they can do.
So if we were to sort of come up with some checkpoints, things that you would advise, you know, one that we're demanding, especially now of our older clients, especially when we find out as we look at their estate planning and documents, doing a plan that, you know, they've named children, we have them sign a form that we are allowed to notify other members of the family, because quite honestly, as an advisor, we're on the front lines. We see the distributions. We know the pattern that we know our clients. And all of a sudden, if that pattern changes, you know, we're right there. But, you know, we need permission. You just can't call up a stranger without that permission and say, hey, do you know this is going on?
Right. And we here at aginginvestor.com, and with me being a lawyer, I recommend using more than a letter. I recommend using a legally viable form that's bulletproof in case someone else in the family challenges it. That's another discussion. But let's say you've gotten permission, whatever way you've got permission. And, you know, you make that your practice that in every single client file, you have at least two, maybe even three trusted people that your client has authorized you to contact. And the minute you see a problem, you contact those individuals and say, hey, maybe this is something unusual. Maybe they needed to, you know, want to take the family around the world. Maybe it's not, but we noticed that there's another 100,000 that came out of that account all of a sudden. And, you know, I thought this person was in assisted living and couldn't go anywhere. So can we talk about what's going on? And then proactive steps can be taken. Sometimes it takes a team. It's not just the advisor and the family member or members. It's the advisor, the family member, the accountant, the estate planning attorney. It might take a team. But I think we need to work collaboratively to thwart this horrific problem of elder abuse. And the more communication we have, the better.
And what about also a check on the advisor? Because we've seen this happen too. There's been advisors who find out an elderly client, let's say the husband handled the finances, husband passes away, wife is on her own, and she's in contact with an advisor. Maybe she doesn't have the financial skill set, somebody to keep the advisor in check.
Oh, you're now touching on one of my very favorite subjects, which is abuse by professionals. And it gets my back up because these are people who know better and they are seizing the opportunity to take advantage of the most vulnerable people, and they know they're vulnerable. And we're talking about someone like my now 94-year-old mother-in-law, who is exactly as you described him. Her husband had handled the finances all their lives. They were married for 62 years. At the age of 90, she had a different financial advisor, and this guy put her into a non-traded real estate investment trust, tied up her money for 15 years. She had no idea, and if it had not been for the work we do at AgingInvestor.com, both consulting with people and trying to educate advisors themselves, we wouldn't have known the difference. But that money would have been tied up for years, even after she passed away, probably. I don't think she's going to live that long. So what we did was contact the advisor and say, it looks to me as if, and my husband is the power of attorney for his mother, and he had me to consult with, so looks to me as if you've put mom into this particular investment that is not what she understood it to be. And you know as well as I do, Jim, that these are very complicated and hard to understand for anybody, especially for someone naive who's never handled investments, has a high school education, doesn't really get it, vulnerable, right? So he got a letter from my husband. He got a phone call from my husband, and they wanted to see the power of attorney, so they got the power of attorney, and then they hemmed and hawed and dragged their feet and made excuses and I think got worried because they realized that they were exposed to potential liability for doing that to her. The long and short of it was that she got her money back, and she now would never do that again. And my husband, as her son and power of attorney and someone who is financially competent, stepped up and now has access to every single thing she does. He watches it every day.
We talked about a number of things that could be done. Some kind of form that you give your financial advisor that has legal backing to it. So if the advisor who's on the front line sees unusual activity, withdrawals, can notify either family members or, let's say, an attorney, or in some cases, probably, you know, even the government.
All of the above, right.
Yeah. And then also a check on the advisor.
Yes. And that means the adult children need to pay attention and get into their parents' business, which makes a lot of people uncomfortable. The parents need to give consent. And we have a lot of techniques that we teach people for how to approach this subject. The first chapter in the book, The Family Guide to Aging Parents, is really about how to have the conversations, plural, about finances.
So, as we close, why don't you tell our listeners, Carolyn, about your website, Aging Parents, and also your book?
Well, I am a registered nurse and an attorney. I have retired from both of those careers, consultant and a mediator for people who have disputes or struggles with their elders. We offer the services of trying to help them, and we have many, many resources at agingparents.com. The book that I wrote is called The Family Guide to Aging Parents, Answers to Your Legal, Financial, and Healthcare Questions. And it really gives people a perspective from my point of view and my husband's point of view, too, about how to address these problems, what to say, how to get into them, what your responsibilities need to be. We also are a resource for people in the financial services field like you, Jim. A lot of them are not doing the good job that you're doing and planning ahead for all these things. We have 6 courses which are certified by the CFP board for financial professionals to get continuing education credit. And we deal with all these subjects, diminished capacity, financial elder abuse, the transfer of wealth in families, family meetings, all of those things. And we have a book called Succeed with Senior Clients just for them, too. So that's what we do, and I hope that with your wonderful podcast and educational efforts that you're making, that more people will be aware that we all need to step up and be more protective of the elders in our lives, even if they seem just fine right now, because that can change.
All right, Carolyn, one more time as we close, would you give out your website again, please?
Yes, it's www.agingparents, plural, agingparents.com. And the book is The Family Guide to Aging Parents, which is available in digital format and audio. It's at agingparents.com. It's also available on Amazon.
Well, listen, Carolyn, I want to thank you for coming on the program. This Barron's article just stirred up something that we are seeing more and more in our practice. And I thought of you as an add-on to really make people aware of this, because this is stuff that if proper attention is given to it, it can be avoided and we can stop this big abuse that is draining $34 billion from elders each year.
And I am really grateful to you, Jim, that you are making this more of a public discussion. I think it's a terrific job that you're doing in trying to help people be aware. The federal and state governments have lots of resources too, and, you know, maybe we'll do a program at some point to talk about the free resources people can download from our government centers. But in the meantime, thank you very much for having me on your program.
You're more than welcome. Thank you, Carolyn.
Take care now.
Well, that concludes my interview with Carolyn Rosenblatt. Once again, folks, really listen to the topics that we covered on Lifetime Income. It stirred in me the article in Barron's this week because I am seeing it more and more in my practice. And I've been in this business 35 years, and I would say in the last 15 years, we're seeing this occur repeatedly on an annual basis. And as Carolyn talked about, it's due to mainly two reasons. People are living longer, which raises the probability of running into dementia, and also the fact that wealth has been built, and especially as we go through bull markets as we have in the last 8 years. In the meantime, on behalf of John Leffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.